Greetings, friends, and welcome to the 5x, your favorite bi-weekly source for rapid-fire board game reviews. This is our annual Second Opinions episode, so a second contributor's thoughts on a game previously covered. This time we have Meeple Lady covering Cat Lady, Ruel talks about Ubongo, I discuss Wingspan, Mason covers Can't Stop, and Sarah discusses Pandemic Iberia. We hope you enjoy the show.
So I'm here to tell you a little secret. Ready? I don't like cats. That statement alone is probably enough to get me banned from some board game circles. But it is what it is. I'm deathly allergic to them, and basically have spent most of my life avoiding these furry felines. So why did I share this personal tidbit about myself? To show you that just because I enjoy a cat-themed board game, it is 100% absolutely not because I am a cat lady. Which brings me to, yep, you guessed it, Cat Lady. Previously covered by Stephanie on episode 23 is from 2017 and is published by Algerock Entertainment Group and designed by and artwork by Josh Wood. It's a darling game that's about 15 to 30 minutes long and consists of a deck of cards, wood cubes, a few cardboard chits, and the most adorable gray kitty cat token. What do I love about Cat Lady? It's a game I usually introduce to newer gamers, especially those who have never encountered card drafting. A mechanism that no doubt shows up in many other games. It's a step up from folks who like playing Sushi Go, which also has card drafting presented in a slightly different way, and also enjoy its artwork. I like teaching Cat Lady because it's one that's easy to learn and equally adorable to look at and play. But for more experienced gamers, Cat Lady can be a quick filler that can be played calmly or ruthlessly, as I'll explain later. A game that can kick off game day or something chill after a long day of work when you don't want to dive into a heavy game, but still have some level of strategy. And you probably love cats. In Cat Lady, you're trying to amass a collection of cats while keeping them fed, clothed, and entertained. Because if you don't, they'll probably do bad things in your house, as cats do. I kid, but you do get negative victory points for each cat not fed at the end of the game. Cat Lady begins with 9 cards dealt out in a 3x3 grid in the middle of the table. On your turn, you draft 3 cards at a time, either in a row or a column. These cards give you food, cats, costumes, catnip, and/or toys. For each cat card, you just put it in front of you, a reminder of all the hungry mouths that you need to feed. When you take a food card, you immediately collect its matching cube from the supply. Toy cards are for set collection, so the more you have at the end of the game, the more points there'll be. Costume cards give you points if you have the most at the end of the game. So when you finish your turn, you move the cat token to the column or row where you just grabbed the cards from, and you refill those 3 spaces with cards from the deck. This cat token essentially marks the row or column that's off limits to the next player. Also, 3 stray cats are randomly chosen for each game. These strays offer variable victory points if you meet their requirements. These cats are a little harder to score points from, but who doesn't want LeVar Purton to join your family? By the way, he's worth 4 points for each set of black, orange, and white cats you feed. Gameplay continues until you can no longer refill the cards in the grid. Players allocate their food to their cats and count up their victory points. If you have unfed cats or extra food, those are worth negative victory points. The person with the most points wins the game. There's one card I haven't mentioned, the spray bottle card. This card allows you to move the cat token to another column or row so that you have access to those 3 cards it was blocking, or block another player from collecting a certain set of cards. Scram, kitty cat, get out of here! I especially enjoy this card and using it, as it raises the stakes when I'm playing with more experienced gamers. It somehow feels like a form of hate drafting to me because you're preventing your opponents from picking up key cards, probably those that will maximize LeVar Purton's scoring. But in all honesty, I enjoy playing this game, despite my aversion to cats. It's feline fun, low stakes, and just quintessentially charming, all in a box that's about as large as a medium-sized hardcover book. And you'll probably be able to get your newer gamers interested in playing other types of games in your collection. A win for everyone. And that's Cat Lady. This is Meeple Lady for the 5x. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as Meeple Lady, or on my website, BoardGameMeepleLady.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting 5x. Happy New Year, everyone!
Hi, this is Rugal Gaviola. Today I'm looking at Ubongo, designed by Gregors Rechtman, with art by Nicholas Neubauer, and published by Cosmos in 2003. Ubongo was covered by Mason Weaver in Episode 9 of the 5x. Ubongo is a real-time puzzle game for 1-4 players, in which your goal is to solve puzzles as fast as you can, thus earning gems of various point values. A round consists of one puzzle, and the game is 9 rounds long. Each player receives a set of 12 polyominoes, think Tetris-shaped pieces, and draws one random puzzle board. On the standard puzzle board side, the puzzle is solved by placing 3 of the Tetris-shaped pieces, while on the reverse advanced side, the puzzle is solved by placing 4 pieces. A player turns over the 1-minute sand timer and rolls a 6-sided die. On the die are symbols that correspond to a row of Tetris shapes on your board that are used to solve your puzzle. Your puzzle consists of an empty shape that you're trying to fill in completely with your allotted pieces. Once you do, you shout Ubongo and wait until others finish theirs or time runs out. The player who shouted Ubongo first receives a 3-point blue gem. Second place receives a 1-point brown gem. All players who solve their puzzles in the allotted time get to draw one random gem from the bag, including the first and second place finishers. Red gems are worth 4 points, blue are 3, green are 2, and brown gems are 1 point each. If you didn't solve your puzzle in time, then no gems for you. Players discard their puzzle boards, draw new ones, then start a new round. After 9 rounds, players add up the point values of their collected gems, and the most points wins. Ubongo combines two of my favorite game mechanisms, puzzle solving and real-time action. My love of puzzles comes from my mom, who's always loved to do jigsaw puzzles. It's a hobby that the rest of my family enjoys too, both as a group and by ourselves. I'm a big fan of real-time games, since they usually mean I'm always involved in the action. While I like brain-burning games where you analyze and plan your current and future turns, I love the fast-paced play and immediate gratification of real-time games. Since everybody has their own unique puzzle board, it does you no good to watch what your opponents are doing. Some may see this as multiplayer solitaire, but I like having my own puzzle to work on. The game's interaction comes through the race against your opponents, since first and second place get extra gems, which means extra points. I like that as long as you complete your puzzle within the time limit, you get something. Even if you're last to solve a puzzle, it's a nice consolation drawing a 4-point red gem that'll keep you close to the leaders. Yes, this adds a bit of randomness, but it's an effective catch-up mechanism. Theme-wise, Ubongo means brain in Swahili, and the graphics are meant to evoke Africa. Kudos to the designers for choosing a non-Eurocentric theme when they could have gone with nearly any theme for their game. I also appreciate how easy it is to include players of all skill levels. Children can easily compete with adults by having them use the standard 3-piece puzzles, while the adults use the advanced 4-piece puzzles. You can also have the children pick out their pieces before the timer starts. Or you can require expert players to only use their non-dominant hand. Officially, Ubongo is supposed to take 25 minutes, but depending on the number of players, you can easily play a game in much less time. I've played 2 and 3 player games in 15 minutes, which seems like the right amount of time. There are several expansions and re-implementations that build on the basic gameplay. Ubongo Extreme, which uses hexagonal shapes and puzzles. Ubongo 3D, which uses 3D pieces. And Ubongo Duel, which tweaks the basic rules for a 2-player game. I haven't played any of these, but based on the original game, I'd try any of these in a heartbeat. There's also a solo game, which is simply you challenging yourself to do as many puzzles as you can within a predetermined amount of time. One bummer about the game, the gems are not colorblind friendly. Since they're used only for keeping score though, these could be swapped out for different colored gems or replaced with cardboard chits. When I play, I have my opponents tell me how many of each color I have so I can tally my score. It's a shame that Cosmos has been publishing this game for so long and still hasn't addressed this issue. Hopefully they'll choose different gems in future editions. Still, I believe Ubongo will continue to be embraced by future generations. It's great for non-gamers since the rules are easily explained and can be one of several lighter games for a casual game night. Of course, if you're not into puzzles or real-time play, then Ubongo is probably a pass. My groups, though, have enjoyed it as a fast abstract game that'll get your brain working, yet it's not a total brain burner. It should be on any gamer's shelves, if only so you can yell, Ubongo! This has been Ruel Gaviola for the 5x. Find me on Twitter at Ruel Gaviola, that's RuelGaviola, or visit my website, ruelgaviola.com.
Hello friends, today for Second Opinions I'd like to talk about Wingspan, which was previously covered by Sarah in episode 54. Not that I strongly disagree with Sarah's review, But Wingspan has become a pretty standard family game around here, so I thought it fit. And clearly we aren't the only ones, because I don't think it's much of a stretch to say that Wingspan has become a bit of a phenomenon over the past couple of years, deservedly catapulting designer Elizabeth Hargrave into the board gaming spotlight and winning the Spiel des Jahres, among countless other awards. Wingspan is a game where you are drawing and playing lovely bird cards from a biro into your tableau using collected resources, and those birds have special abilities when played, when activated, or between turns. Well, most of them do anyway. And this right here is where I run into trouble with Wingspan. You see, Wingspan is listed on BGG as a drafting and hand management game, and Sarah says Wingspan is an engine building game, and they're probably right. But for me, Wingspan is a tableau builder, meaning I regularly pass up the quote-unquote optimal move to put another beautiful bird card down in my board. Maybe this is why I often lose at this game, or at least the base game in the first expansion, as at least with the base game and first expansion, I've been told that the quote-unquote big egg strategy is a good dominant play, but I just can't pass up putting out another bird. Sarah did an excellent job explaining the gameplay, but I'll touch on a few points. In the game, you draft a bird from the biro and then use resources to pay to put them on your board. Then when you take actions, in theory, those birds make the action better by pushing you further along to make that action more efficient. For instance, placing another bird in the forest lets you take more food dice from the bird feeder. And also, they often activate on the action you added it to, like letting you take a free invertebrate from the supply when you take that action. So that's ostensibly why you're placing bird cards on your board. Though there are round-around and endgame goals that score extra points. But to be perfectly frank, with either goals, the points are pretty small, and it wouldn't hurt you too badly to skip one to achieve a longer-term goal. Which is good because card availability matching your goals or the round goals can be hit or miss. Not as completely random and ruin your plans as the cards in Terraforming Mars, but not everything will go your way. That's one of the few things I'm so-so on with Wingspan. I prefer games where everyone makes a plan and whoever executes the plan better wins, over games where luck of the draw or available cards dictates who wins. Still, in Wingspan there are ways to churn your hand to hopefully get better cards, so if you can get those and use those cards, it's all the better for you. I also feel like the points on bird cards are pretty insignificant. Sure, they add up eventually with enough bird cards, and the points are balanced with birds without abilities being worth more than birds with abilities. But again, I don't really find myself weighing points highly, or if a bird will add to a personal bonus when choosing which bird I want. Though, again, maybe this is why I lose a lot. So that's what I don't like about Wingspan. What do I like? Well, for starters, we love the new Swift Start promo pack. I believe it's standard these days, but we had to get ours separately. The Swift Start pack gives everyone specific cards and specific food at the start of the game, and then walks them through the first couple of turns. At a time when we have well over 100 games to play, it's nice to have a small refresher when playing a game you haven't played in a while. It's just enough for an, oh, that's right, that's what we're doing, moment. And then it's off to the races. Speaking of add-ons, we also like the pink actions for the European Bird expansion. Wingspan already had some interaction with a few action cards that allow everyone to collect food or draw a card. But the pink actions are one-time between-turn actions on birds that allow you to do something like, when someone takes a lay egg action, then you can also take a lay egg action. It makes you pay closer attention to what the other players are doing, which, I mean, I should be doing anyway, but it's always good to get a reminder to do that. Obviously, we enjoy the art in the game quite a bit. We used to keep bird feeders going year-round and enjoy watching the birds a lot until we found out that Utah has lots and lots of rats around, and not just in the capital. But one of my absolute favorite parts of the game is the number of actions per turn. You see, you start the game with 8 tokens for your actions for the first round. We, of course, have the bird-shaped tokens for Meeplesaurus, but the game comes with colored cubes that work just fine. At the end of the round, you then use one token to mark your score on the round end bonus, meaning you have one fewer action next turn. Then again, after the next 2 rounds, to the point where you have only 5 actions on that final round. I think this is brilliant, as by the end, each action has more bonus actions triggering off, so it's a brilliant way to streamline an engine building game like this, and it's something I would love to see implemented in more games. And lastly, but certainly not least, I like that it's a nice relaxing game with the family. No knife fight in a phone booth or backstabbing your father in the back. Games are competitive, but not in a mean way, and that's something my whole family can get behind. So that's my second take on Wingspan. I hope you've had an opportunity to try it, and if not, I hope you get a chance soon. I would personally like to try the Birds of Asia expansion sometime soon, but with COVID, who knows when that might happen. Until next time, stay safe.
Hi, I'm Mason Weaver, and let's talk about Can't Stop. I'm a huge Sid Sackson fan. I've played dozens of his games, and I've talked about some of them here on the show before. Now, since this is a second opinions episode, I decided to talk about a game that I was actually mad at myself for not already having discussed when Christy covered it back in episode 95. Like a lot of Sid Sackson games, Can't Stop, originally published in 1980 by Parker Brothers, is built on the bones of an older pen and paper title, in this case 1974's The Great Races, which itself has some heavy connections to a Sackson game I have actually discussed before here, Extra, back from episode 65, later republished as Can't Stop Express by those guys that unfortunately have Sackson's publishing rights and continue to milk them. They're all games linked by the idea of dice combination probabilities. That is, when you roll two dice, there are 36 possible combinations of the two faces, six sides squared because there are two dice. So the probabilities go something like this. Rolling a 7 is a 6 in 36 likelihood, but you've only got a 1 in 36 chance of rolling a 2 or a 12. That doesn't mean that it never happens, of course, it just means that you're going to roll 7s the most often over a long period of time. Dice odds are like a stair-step triangle. 5 of 36 for 6s and 8s, 4 of 36 for 5 and 9s, and so on. So Sid's idea here is pretty simple. Move up tracks of different lengths that take this probability into account. In Great Race, everyone is moving up racetracks, and all the races must be completed, and you only get one roll per turn. There's no pushing your luck, there's no crapping out. You throw four dice, pick two combinations, and mark the sheet in your color, then pass the sheet to the next person. Of course, you could play this on a big board with little plastic horses, too, which would be fun, but, you know, it's a lot of horses. I think if you figured out how to play this with more people on a physical set, which I think would really be more fun, you'd probably want to throw in some points for third place as well, but that's probably another conversation. Great Race is not a complicated game, but of course neither is Can't Stop. They're very structurally similar, but come from a different headspace, and I think the push your luck and sudden death elements in Can't Stop are what really make it sing. Every turn in Can't Stop, you're also moving up a track, trying to be the first person to make it to the top of three of the numbers. You roll the four dice, you pick your combinations, and you put your placeholder tokens on the board, but then you have a choice. Do you roll again and chance losing the progress you've made? And this is the decision space that makes Can't Stop great. You can only move up three tracks per turn. Once those tracks are committed, if you keep rolling and you can't legally move, you're done. You've lost all the progress you've made in the round, possibly even losing a winning track if you're a dummy like me and like to push your luck. Late in a game of Can't Stop, you're often one turn from winning, but the sudden death endgame of any one player winning three tracks means that no matter how well you think you're doing, another player's run of good luck and daring may just be a dagger in your guts. Can't Stop currently, unfortunately, is not exactly in print in the sense that you could just go to Target and buy it. I know I typically only cover games that are in print and accessible, but this one's pretty easy to proxy for yourself. All of this is partially because Eagle Griffin Games, who I don't care for, a fact that I have expressed on here and in a number of other places on a number of other occasions, are always trying to find new ways to make money off Sackson. This game goes out of print, it goes back into print. There are new editions, there are special editions, there's travel versions, there's a roll and write, which I mentioned earlier, which isn't really Can't Stop at all. And now, for some reason, there's a new ugly, overpriced table hog they're calling Route 66 the Mother Road. It's overproduced Kickstarter junk that costs about the same as what buying a vintage copy of Can't Stop would cost you, so don't waste your money. Fortunately, there are also many international versions you can buy on Amazon.jp or .de, and even on BoardGameGeek. You can also just make your own out of poker chips on a table, a Quirkle set, the back of a cereal box, and a Sharpie. You just need four dice, three white tokens, and 10 tokens of one color per player. And there are plenty of printable boards on BoardGameGeek as well. If you happen to find a vintage Parker Brothers Stop Sign edition, you should also pick up a copy of the terrible Parker Brothers game Advance to Boardwalk, which is boring and stupid, but it uses the same molds as the Can't Stop pieces. A copy of Boardwalk can let you do custom colors, can make usable a Can't Stop board with all of its pieces missing, or, and this is I think the most intriguing, add a fifth and even sixth player to Can't Stop, which I think would just be madness, but I would really like to try sometime. And there are a number of other ways you can play Can't Stop. Now, at two player, you might want to play up to four completed tracks, as it makes the game a little crunchier and more strategic, though personally, I don't think it's necessary. Sid Sackson's own notes mention a skip variant where there aren't any stacks and you just jump over other players' markers. This makes an already quick game even faster. He also suggests a forced roll if you're playing with stacks. That is, if you land on another player's piece, you must roll again. Scary stuff, but I can see how it would really heighten the drama. So, who should play Can't Stop? People who like dice games. People who like push-your-luck games. people who play games with non-gamers, and people who like swearing and pounding the table when they bust. I give Can't Stop 4 out of 4 dice rolls when you should have stopped at just 3. I'm Mason Weaver. You can find me on Twitter and occasionally Instagram at Discount Compost and on Board Game Geek and Board Game Arena as Breakfast Core.
Do you remember when the word pandemic meant a great co-op game by Matt Leacock and Rob Davio? And that's basically all it meant in your daily life. Yeah, me neither. We're heading into 2 full years of the global pandemic that, I don't know about you, but it changed my life in so many ways that it's sometimes hard to remember how things were before. The coronavirus pandemic has caused incalculable loss, suffering, and upheaval. In the midst of that, I haven't been able to bring myself to play a single game of any version of Pandemic for 22 months now. I just can't. Before COVID, I used to play solo to unwind after work all the time. I'd try different versions, expansions, and character combinations just to see what I liked. And Pandemic Iberia was one of the best. Pandemic Iberia, designed by Jesus Torres Castro and Matt Leacock and published in 2016, was part of a series of spin-off games which came out around that time and used the Pandemic system with different themes like Cthulhu, the Netherlands, or Rome. Of those 4, Iberia is thematically the closest to original Pandemic. I won't get into the rules in too much detail today, but if you want to know more, check out Mike's excellent review way back in episode 16. The game is set in the Iberian Peninsula in 1848. The 4 diseases are actual historical diseases: cholera, typhus, malaria, and yellow fever. You win Pandemic Iberia by researching these diseases, not curing them, because back then there was no cure. Likewise, eradicate disease is not part of the game, because those diseases could not be eradicated. There's no charter flight action in Pandemic Iberia for obvious reasons. You can move more quickly by ship on the water or by rail on the land, but you have to lay the rail first. I love that. You want to use the infrastructure? Okay, go build the infrastructure. The roles and special event cards have been modified somewhat as well. I'm fond of the Railway Man and Sailor roles, both of whom help with movement. The Railway Man can build rail faster, and the Sailor can take people with him when he travels by sea. What can I say? The Dispatcher is always my favorite role in original Pandemic. I like movement. Pandemic Iberia's components do a lot of the work of reinforcing the theme. The board looks like an antique map of Spain. The cards, rulebook, and box have a 19th century design feel. The card backs even have patterns like Spanish ceramic tiles. Excellent work by artists Atha Kanani and Chris Quilliams in creating a game that looks like it belongs in a place and time. The first time I played original Pandemic, when we got to our first epidemic, I remember the person teaching said, "Okay, now shuffle the discard pile and put it on the top of the deck." And I said, "On the top? Are you out of your mind? Put them on top?" I was aghast at how much harder the game was about to become. That feeling of gut-wrenching tension, watching the board spiral out of control, holding your breath with every card draw, is what I love best about Pandemic. And it's kind of a shame that the more you play Pandemic, the more you crack the code, so to speak, the less you experience that tension. That's why I love Pandemic variations that make the game harder in unexpected ways. Pandemic Iberia includes 2 challenges that do a great job of ramping up the difficulty. First, the Historical Diseases challenge adds a unique special effect to each of the diseases. Whenever yellow fever is placed in a port city, it spreads to all adjacent port cities. That sort of thing. But I really love the challenge Influx of Patients. It simulates the historical migration of sick people during an actual epidemic. If a new hospital was built that specialized in that disease, people would travel there from all over seeking treatment. In Pandemic Iberia, hospitals are color-coded to match the diseases. And in the Influx of Patients challenge, when you build a hospital, cubes of that color start moving towards it. The cubes can travel on foot, one city at a time, or they can travel by rail, just like the players. If you've laid a lot of rail on your map, it becomes very easy for cubes to get to the hospital, where they will cluster and cause an outbreak, over and over. If your pandemic strategy is focused on mobility, which mine almost always is, like I said, the dispatcher is my favorite role, this is fiendishly clever. The more rail you build, the faster those cubes get to the hospital, the more you scramble to prevent outbreaks in hospital cities. You can lose the game because of over-reliance on the very mechanism you're using to win it. It's maddening in the best way. Pandemic Iberia is currently out of print, but you can get it here and there from online sellers and friendly local game stores. It was originally released as a quote-unquote limited collector's edition, albeit a much larger print run than you would normally expect for something called a collector's edition. Z-Man Games has announced that they will be reprinting the special-themed Pandemic games with a slight name change, Iberia Pandemic System instead of Pandemic Iberia. They say the gameplay will not change, and these reprints will not be considered new editions. I understand that some owners of Pandemic Iberia are upset about the prospect of a reprint because it will no longer be a limited collectible. To which I can only say, get over yourself. My enjoyment of this wonderful game doesn't hinge on other people not being able to play it. And that's Pandemic Iberia. Enough of a game to get me to play Pandemic again in the middle of a global pandemic. My name is Sarah. Look me up on Twitter, at Sarah Ovenall. Especially if you love Pandemic, but have been avoiding playing it because of everything. Then I really want to hear from you.
The 5x is a proud member of the Inside Voices Network. You can find more episodes on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or Spotify, and support the show on patreon.com/5xgames if you're feeling generous. We're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram under the handle 5xgames, or you can simply go to 5xgames.com to find links to all of our social media, as well as all of our episodes, contributor bios, and the official podcast store. Until next time, thanks for listening.